Our scripture reading comes from Colossians 3, 12 to 14. As God's chosen ones, holy and beloved, clothe yourselves with compassion, kindness, humility, meekness or gentleness, and patience. Bear with one another, and if anyone has a complaint against another, forgive each other, just as the Lord has forgiven you, so you must forgive. Above all, clothe yourselves with love, which binds everything together in perfect harmony. Jaron, we invite you to come and share with us this morning.
Good morning, everyone. Before I start, I would like to give a quick disclaimer that this is for my philosophy class. And in turn, this means I will be taking an approach to this sermon where I'll be asking a lot of questions, both in Christian faith and life. I also want to reiterate that questions do not mean doubt. Questions just mean we are trying to learn more together, and that's what I hope to do this morning. If you have any questions for me, like my dad mentioned, I will be here during worship response to gather a few questions from you guys so we can explore this topic deeper. One other thing I would like to briefly say is that I like to think a lot about Jesus, specifically within this topic, as a philosopher himself. A lot of people don't really have the idea that philosophy and faith can go together, but I like to think that it can, because just like a lot of philosophers, all we're trying to do when we worship God is try to find answers, and we're trying to have someone or a being to rely on so that we can find our way through this life. So try to think of Jesus as a philosopher this morning, okay? Awesome. So the title of my sermon this morning is, What Do We Owe to Each Other and to God? These are the two questions that we will be exploring this morning. I will also be focusing on some of the main philosophical thinkers who explore these concepts, such as Socrates and Hannah Arendt, as well as Jesus. And hopefully we will learn how to be good neighbors and also good to ourselves and God. To begin, let's talk about what I mean when I ask you what we owe to each other. What do you guys think that phrase means? Any answers for me? Any thoughts? What does it mean when we talk about what we owe to each other? Respect. Honesty.
Care.
Care. Patience. Relationships. I notice a theme that we're talking about a lot of the virtues that we have been mentioning early this morning. And that is going to be a focus of this sermon today, as we are talking about Socrates and Jesus, who both talk a lot about the virtues of life. In ethics, we attempt to determine how to live morally, to determine what is right and what is wrong, and what is part of living a moral life is finding a balance between doing things for yourself and giving to others. Like most subjects in philosophy, this is a tough topic to digest, since most people and philosophers want some universal, always applicable moral code that can be applied to any given situation to tell you what you should do and what you shouldn't do. The problem with this concept of a binary system is that each extreme end has its own problem. If you believe that you live on this earth to serve yourself and only yourself, that obviously has its own problem. You want to serve yourself because time is precious and you don't have time to care for others. In that case, then there should be no motive to do anything for anyone but yourself. Obviously, that can't be right, because if we lived in a world that was only full of selfishness, we would probably all be killing each other, which is obviously not good. So let's flip to the opposite end of the spectrum. And by the way, regardless of if you believe in an afterlife that punishes those for doing bad on earth and rewards them for doing good, this self-serving justice system doesn't feel right. So let's flip to the opposite. The side that very often in Christian faith we like to side with much more: always serve others before yourself. This sounds wonderful in principle, but it has just as many flaws. We discussed this during an offering last Sunday when we were talking about Why should I give my spare change? Why shouldn't I? If I have something to give, be it pocket change or really anything more than I already have, I should give it to those who are more in need because it is what I owe to them. Sounds wonderful, right? But how do you know when to stop giving? The majority of you are likely living off much more, sorry to assume, but you're living off much more than the bare necessities, to say. So why don't you give everything that you have to those living below the poverty line until you are just getting by? Every time you choose to eat out instead of making something at home, you could choose to use whatever sum of money you were going to use to help out a sick kid in a third world country or help towards supporting refugees, but you don't. Talking like this is when some people tend to get defensive and say, why are you telling me to do this? There are billionaires who are out there who could give way more than me so much easier. And they have a point. This debate has many parallels to the ever famous golden rule proclaimed by Jesus, written in Matthew 7:12. Do to others what you wish they would do to you. In a perfect world, this system would work. We would all contribute to one another and live with sunshine and rainbows. But unfortunately, many choose not to give, especially those who are holding the majority of the wealth. Regardless of their position to save lives with much more ease, they don't. I know it's difficult to acknowledge sometimes, but every day we have some capacity to save a human life with the extra money we have, and we choose not to. You may donate to a charity that saves lives, and that's great, that's wonderful. But why don't you donate more? And how do you know that you are donating to the charity with the most impact on lives? This is the biggest flaw with this end of the extreme moral code. The happiness pump, as many know it, is what becomes of you if you just give, give, give. It is not a sustainable way of living because you're not caring for yourself. The question now becomes, how do we be good neighbors to the people around us and ourselves while still taking care of number one? One of my personal favorite philosophers has some ideas on this matter. Before I talk about Socrates, I'm going to give you a quick background because I want you to understand that Socrates was in no way perfect. Socrates was pro-slavery, and he would often go around in his youth days provoking the wise men of his time by telling them he knew more about the world simply because he accepted that he knew nothing. If that confuses you, it should. It confused me at the start as well. All he was trying to say is that the ultimate knowledge was realizing that in reality, we have no concept of anything. We are making up everything as we go, and we're simply learning. So by him knowing that, he was smarter than you. Now, this provocative behavior did get him killed, so I don't suggest you do the same. But I would like to talk about one thing I do think he was onto, and that was his work on eudaimonia. Forgive me if I begin to sound like my dad here, but eudaimonia comes from the ancient Greek meaning human flourishing, or living a fulfilling life. Flourishing is not something that is practiced and judged through each individual moral action, but rather it's something that happens over the span of your lifetime. Socrates believed that if you aren't constantly trying every day to learn from yourself, improve on yourself, that your life isn't worth living. You're not doing it right. And in an abstract way, this is very similar to what Jesus wants us to practice with God. God, in this case, being Socrates' equivalent to ultimate knowledge. Matthew 22, verse 37 says, "You shall love the Lord with all your heart, with all your soul, and all your mind." Socrates wants us to constantly give, learn, and love with each other, virtues. Wants us to contribute to our communities and hear all voices, big and small. Because in reality, even if there was some ultimate moral code out there, it isn't possible for any human on this earth to determine one objectively, since bias will always taint it. Jesus wants the same from us. He doesn't want us to follow one tyrant, one human, but to pursue self-growth and follow God, an unbiased objector. Now, it seems like we have our answer. The works of Socrates and the preaching of Jesus have told us that what we owe each other day and day out to each person isn't something measured by individual acts. We owe each other our best try every day, and not doing our best isn't failure, it's part of growth. We fail when we stop trying to flourish. But there is a piece we're missing. How are we meant to act towards a person who decides to serve themselves only? In our current philosophy, this is very flawed because we have everyone else who is growing in a community where they give a little bit and they take a little bit. But as soon as you add someone in there who only takes, they start to accumulate all the wealth. And eventually they become this overlording tyrant with all these blind followers. And this may seem like a little pessimistic, possibly even a slippery slope that we're falling down, but we see it in real time in our world everywhere. Prime example being American politics right now. Socrates and Jesus don't have super clear answers as to how we are meant to deal with and include these outliers in our moral neighborhood. But another thinker by the name of Hannah Arendt does. Quick background on Hannah Arendt. She is a more modern time philosopher. She was a lot more recent than Socrates. And her philosophies are a little bit more political, and they kind of teach us how we deal with the tyrants of our time, which is kind of what I'm going to get into. We will start with issue number one. How do we prevent the self-servers in our community from obtaining all this power and wealth in the first place? Hannah Arendt will tell us that the key to all societies is to hear the voice of the collective. Hannah talks about the importance of calling out those who threaten to disturb the balance early, before they can begin to take over. In other words, if we all exercise our basic freedoms of speech and independent thought and make decisions as a community, the self-servers will be held accountable and our society can adjust around them accordingly before our own fear prevents us from letting our voices be heard. Jesus is actually a prime example of how Hannah Arendt wants us to act within our communities. Jesus calls out the leaders of his time for their selfish ways. As he famously says, "Give to Caesar what is Caesar's and give to God what is God's." But he also reminds his followers that we don't need to punish or harm those wrongdoers because God will hold them accountable. God represents the united mass in Hannah Arendt's political philosophy, but in a lot of ways in Christianity, God also does represent everyone. He is the creator who created all of us, and therefore he represents all of us. By letting the self-server's greed be known to the public, the mass becomes aware of their wrongdoing, and no longer fear the idea of being the only one who is seeing a problem. This prevents our moral neighborhood from manipulation and harm. That person can continue with their life and will be welcome within our community, our neighborhood, with the knowledge that no one is afraid to call them out if they try anything again. But what about issue number two? What if we do fail to call out the self-servers and they do become rich and collect this blind following? When I say blind following, I just mean the group of people who choose to follow that tyrant without really knowing why they are doing so and the wrongdoings they are committed. And this is what Hannah Arendt refers to as the banality of evil. Sounds very dark. That's kind of because it is. The most famous example of the banality of evil is when we think of very gruesome Nazi Germany, where a lot of the members of this party were simply following orders. And this was a very controversial argument. They were just doing what they were being told, which is something that in a lot of ways we see in our society, and even in Christianity, we are doing what God tells us to do. Now, obviously, I'm not trying to compare God to Hitler, two very polar opposites. But the principle is the same. People do things because they are told to, and they're not necessarily aware if it's bad. So does that make that person inherently evil? Well, that's what Hannah Arendt is kind of trying to get at here. So once again, we have this mass who is corrupted. We want to let the leader's wrongdoings and greed be known to everyone. How do we solve that before? We need a mass behind us so we don't have fear.
but where is the mass right now? It's blindly following that leader. So we're stuck in a loop. So issue number two is, how do we get that blind following back on our side? Well, this is tough because there isn't really a good way of saving all those people. If it was as easy as saying that guy's wrong and that guy's right, then Hannah Arendt could retire. We could all retire. But obviously we don't have the power to snap someone away from what they believe is right, nor do we really get to say that we are objectively right either. That's not our job. And this is where the banality of evil comes in. Hannah Arendt wants us to understand that good people can do bad things when they are under the influence of bad leaders. This doesn't excuse any immoral actions on their behalf, but it also doesn't mean we should treat them any different. And Jesus says the same thing, love your enemy. We aren't going to change people's viewpoints by yelling it in their face louder than the other guy. We simply include them in a life where they can express themselves and decide and realize on their own terms that they messed up. It's a flawed aspect of our human nature, but our ego often gets away in the way of our better judgment. This is, once again, what Jesus means when he tells us to love our enemies. We don't owe each other less or more based on beliefs or actions. Because after all, how can we expect someone to change if we aren't willing to learn and change too? So let's summarize what we have learned today. Living life with all the other beings around us is not as simple as a binary good action, bad action system. We can't only serve ourselves because then we'll be full of selfishness, and we can't only serve others because we'll become this never-ending happiness pump until we're deprived of our basic human needs. We refer to this balance in between as flourishing. Socrates teaches us that flourishing, and on the Christian end of the spectrum, following God, requires you, most importantly, to be open to learning. Trying to improve every day by loving more and giving more is what we owe to those around us. Flourishing is what makes strong communities and strong connections with God. Connecting with those who choose to serve themselves only is just as important. Hannah Arendt and Jesus alike remind us that we should speak up when we witness something we disagree with. Hear out everyone's voice so that those who threaten to disturb your community understand their place. And most importantly, when you don't have the mass by your side, you don't need to tell them that they're wrong. Continue to learn from them and stand by them. Let them come around on their own terms. It's not our life to live. We have to accept that we can't control the decisions of others and realize that what we can control is what we individually owe to everyone, and through everyone, God. It is our best effort every day, trying to improve, learn, love, and flourish, because none of us will be perfect, and that's okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Jaron, for leading us in a lot of reflection that we, I hope, have a lot of further thoughts on and questions about in worship response. So please come for worship response to engage some more with Jaron afterwards. As we wrap up our series on cultivating healthy relationships today, I would be remiss as your pastor if I ended without noting two critical considerations for all of us. And those are, number one, it is normal to struggle with relationships at some point. And number two, we can't cultivate healthy relationships alone. Of course, these considerations might seem like stating the obvious, but I think sometimes there's a temptation to think, especially when talking of relationship challenges or unhealthy relationships, that we need to pretend everything is okay, or just tough it out and sort out our problems in private. As Christians who believe that God has called us into fellowship of care and mutual support, I think we need to disagree with the idea that we can tough it out or keep our struggles private. We need each other. We need more than just our own selves or our own private faith. We need more than just a spouse or a family member. We need more than just our church community, even. Seeking help is not weakness. Rather, it is a sign of strength and a sign that new life is possible. We live, fortunately, in a time and in a place in the world where God has blessed us with many layers of support in our communities that can help us navigate relationship challenges. And so today, too, I wanted to point out that there are different local organizations that can help address relationship challenges that any of us might be facing. Recently at Bloomingdale, we had Susan Schwarzentruber visit us from Shalom Counseling. And Shalom is one organization in particular that can be accessed for support in navigating relationship challenges. Another organization that is right within our neighborhood that we regularly support is Woolwich Community Services, who offers so many different forms of community support to all ages, from young to old, and can also offer referrals to programs within the Waterloo region to help address any relational challenges you might be facing. And so, as your pastor, I want you to be encouraged and know that whatever relationship in your life needs extra cultivation and nurture, you are not alone. And please reach out if you need help.